This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Goodbye Vitamin, a novel. Written by Rachel Kong, performed by Therese Plummer.
December 26th. Tonight, a man found Dad's pants in a tree lit with Christmas lights. The stranger called and said, "I have some pants belonging to a Howard Young." "Well, shit," I said. I put the phone down to verify that Dad was home and had pants on. He was, and did. Yesterday, on Mom's orders, I'd written his name and our number in permanent marker onto the tags of all his clothes. Apparently, what he's done, in protest, is pitch the numbered clothing into trees. Up and down Euclid, his slacks and shirts hang from the branches. The downtown trees have their holiday lights in them, and this man who called had, while driving, noticed the clothes, illuminated. December 27th. In the morning, when I go to fetch them, city workers are removing the lights from the trees and the decorative bows from the lampposts. One man unties a bow and tosses it to his partner on the ground. All the great bright gold bows are piled in the bed of an enormous pickup truck parked in the plaza. In that same plaza, a frustrated man is saying to his dog, "Why are you being this way?" A baby in a stroller is wearing sunglasses. "Dad, all my hard work," I say, later at home. I've collected a pair of pants, two shirts, a few knotted up ties.
"Now that's unnecessary,"
Dad says angrily. When I return them. I got here on Christmas Eve. I'm home for the holidays, like you're supposed to be. It's the first time in a long time. Under ordinary circumstances, the circumstances that had become ordinary, I would have gone to Joel's. His mother would have popped popcorn for garlands, and his father would have baked a stolen. His twin brother would have hit on me. In the bathroom, there would have been a new grocery brand toothbrush with a gift label on it. My name in his mother's handwriting. Ruth. This year, with nowhere to go, no Joel and no Charleston, I made the drive down. It's been 3 or 4 Christmases away. From San Francisco, where I live, it would have been an easy 6 hours south.
"Up to you,"
Joel would say. But I always chose Charleston. "Merry Christmas," we'd tell my parents over speakerphone. Except for Linus gone, everything was the same. Mom had decorated her biggest potted ficus in tinsel and lights, and with the ornaments we'd made as kids. Painted macaroni framing our school pictures, ancient peanuts I'd painted into snowmen with apathetic faces. She'd hung our stockings over the fireplace, even Linus's. When I asked if I could shell a snowman to see what the 20-year-old peanut inside looked like, Mom said sternly, "Don't you dare." Christmas morning, Dad pulled out a small, worn red notebook. He explained he's kept it since I was very little. Inside, there are letters to me. He'd been waiting for the proper time to share them, but it had slipped his mind, wouldn't you know, until now. He showed me a page from this notebook. "Today you asked me where metal comes from. You asked me what flavor are germs. You were distressed because your pair of gloves had gone missing. When I asked you for a description, you said, 'They are sort of shaped like my hands.'" Then he closed the notebook very suddenly and said, as though angry, "That's enough." December 29th. Now Mom is asking if I could stay a while to keep an extra eye on things. By things, she means Dad, whose mind is not what it used to be. It comes as a surprise. Things aren't so bad. Dad doesn't seem any different, on top of which my mother hates to ask for anything. "Just the year," Mom repeats when I can't manage to answer. "Think about it." On my way to the bathroom, I catch my mother shouting, "No, no, no, you're expensive," to a vitamin she's dropped. Ginkgo, I think. The first thing started approximately last year. Dad forgetting his wallet, forgetting faces, forgetting to turn the faucet off. Then it was bumping into things and feeling tired even after full nights of sleep. That he'd been a drinker, Dr. Lung said, didn't help. There is presently no single test or scan that can diagnose dementia with complete accuracy. It's only after the person is dead that you can cut his or her brain open and look for telltale plaques and tangles. For now, it's process of elimination. What we have are tests that rule out other possible causes of memory loss. In diagnosing Alzheimer's, doctors can only tell you everything that it isn't. What my father doesn't have, hyperthyroidism, a kidney or liver disorder, an infection, a nutritional deficiency. Deficiencies of vitamin B12 and folic acid can cause memory loss and are treatable.
I'm just straight up demented, Dad says.
December 31st. This morning I packed an overnight bag, wished my parents a happy new year, and began the drive to Silver Lake to spend New Year's Eve with Bonnie. She's the one with the plans. For the night, I mean. Lately, it's hard to make plans at all. Traffic is worse than usual on the 101, but festive at least. Every window is rolled down. To my right, a tan man in an also-tan escapade has a Christmas song playing. It's the one that starts like the Pachelbel Canon in D, and then some kids start singing, "On this night, on this night, on this very Christmas night." He is blasting it, tapping his cigarette out his window to the tune. For a long time on the freeway, I trail a chicken truck that rains white feathers onto my windshield. I try to windshield wipe them, which only results in their getting stuck in the wipers and moving enchantingly. Robert Kearns, who invented the intermittent windshield wiper, was legally blind in one eye. It's something Joel told me once. An errant champagne cork shot Kearns in the eye on his wedding night. While driving his Ford Galaxy through light rain, he had the idea of modeling the windshield wiping mechanism on the human eye, which blinks every few seconds rather than continuously. I remember absently parroting that fact to Joel years later, forgetting in that moment that he was the one who'd originally told me.
"Oh, really?" he said,
as though it was the first time he'd ever heard it. Even now, I don't know if he was humoring me or if he'd genuinely forgotten. The door to Bonnie's apartment is unlocked, so I let myself in. The room smells like toast. In anticipation of me, she's rolled her rug to one side of the living room and laid the sports section out on the living room floor. "Hey!" Bonnie calls from the bathroom, then flushes. "The heater is broken, so I'm running the oven all day," she explains. "Can I interest you in some toast?" Bonnie is a painter, but lately she makes her living three or four different ways. One of the ways is cutting hair. She won't cut your hair if you've newly been through a breakup. That's her rule. "See how you feel in 6 weeks," she'll tell you. And if you still want the haircut then, she'll do it. But not before. The reason she's making an exception for me is that after a breakup, all I want to do is grow a cloak of hair and hide in it. Because she is my oldest, best friend, we met as children at the college where our fathers taught. She knows this. "Sit," Bonnie instructs, pointing at the kitchen stool she's relocated to the living room. She snips a neat hole out of the front page and drops the newspaper bib over my head. She hands me a glass of iced tea, which is more for her entertainment than my refreshment. Occasionally, I raise the tea to my face, trying my best not to move, and stab myself with a straw. Divorce Court is on TV while Bonnie cuts my hair. At the end of the show, after the man has not gotten the settlement he wanted, and neither party is very satisfied, he is asked if he has anything to add.
"You still feed me,"
he says ominously into the camera, addressing his ex-wife.
"You still the fool."
What Joel said, that it was not about her. But how do you believe a thing like that when the facts so unquestionably dwarf the claim? The facts are, the two of them are now living in South Carolina, not far from his family, happier, presumably, than we ever were. Last June in San Francisco, all our things packed into boxes, I had to caramelize onions in the only clean pan I could find, a cookie sheet. I mixed them in with potatoes I'd microwaved and mashed. And that was our last dinner, though I hadn't known at the time. We were switching neighborhoods. That was what I thought. I thought we were moving into a one-bedroom in Bernal Heights. I thought we were moving because the space was bigger and the rent was curiously reasonable. Joel had taken great care to pack his things separate from mine, and I had thought that he was only Joel being Joel, when actually, it was Joel not coming with me. There were signs, I guess, I'd chosen to ignore. At parties, talking to another woman, Joel used to reach out to touch me lightly when I walked by, as if to say, "Don't worry, I still like you the best." I noticed when it stopped happening. I told myself that it wasn't anything. Anyway, the point is, I didn't catch on. And what could I have done differently if I had? He told me, "Ruth, don't get me wrong, I care for you deeply." He said that. And what I thought then, and what I still think now, was, that's not something to say. That isn't anything. "Forget it," Bonnie says. "He doesn't deserve you," she says sternly, the way friends assure with a lot of conviction, but have no way of knowing for certain. What if we deserved each other exactly? The party is in Highland Park at the home of Bonnie's friend Charles from art school. Before it, we drink tumblers of vodka in Bonnie's kitchen and chase them with baby carrots dipped in sugar, the way we used to. At the door, greeting us, Charles seems nervous or flustered. His face is completely pink. "Does he have a crush on you?" I ask Bonnie once Charles has moved on to greeting newer guests. But she says no. It's that he's eaten too many Wheat Thins. All Charles had was a niacin flush from all the enriched flour. It's happened before, Bonnie tells me. The two of them dated very briefly in college, and that's how she knows. He still loves Wheat Thins. He's still unable to exercise restraint around them. Inside, a group is assembled in front of a TV that's playing the recorded broadcast of the ball dropping in Times Square. Many of them have familiar faces, but I have trouble placing them. Three or four people, you can tell, have fresh haircuts. I'm relieved it isn't just me. "Ruth?" one of the familiar-looking people says. He has a thick red beard and ears the shape of paperclips. Jared, my high school biology lab partner. I know, by the unabashed way he's talking, he's forgotten that he was not a very good lab partner. He's a sushi chef now. He graduated recently from a special sushi academy. He has a knack for peeling eels. Jared asks what I've been up to and if I'm living in L.A., and I tell him, no, San Francisco. But I'm considering staying home for the year to keep an eye on my dad, who's having lapses in memory. I don't know why I say that. Lapses in memory. It was what my mother had said, and I was echoing it because I'd never had to articulate it before. "Only for the year," I say again. He raises a punch glass full of something bright blue and knocks it against my champagne. "Cheers," Jared says, full of admiration. It's too much. I excuse myself. I tell Jared I've forgotten something in my car. In the car, I stretch my legs out across the back seat. I reach gingerly into my purse to retrieve my phone. Gingerly, because my purse is full of trash. So many receipts and pamphlets and ticket stubs, I'm afraid I'll get a paper cut. There's a voicemail from Joel's mother. She's called to wish me a happy new year, to see if I'm doing all right. I wonder if it's a drunk dial. She always liked me. Sometimes it seemed like she liked me more than she liked her son. And I wonder what she thinks of Kristen. I let myself fantasize that she dislikes her so much that she's had to call to tell me so. There is, inexplicably, a cigarette in my pocket where somebody must have slipped it. It's bent, and I straighten it and roll down a window to smoke it. It's menthol. While people shout the countdown and the old year becomes the new one. Joel could be indecisive in a way that exasperated his mother. With him around, I could assume the opposite position. I think she liked that about me. Empowered by his waffling, I could decide, "Let's do this," and "Let's go here," and "Are you sure?" Because I am. Now I think, I did that? My phone rings a minute after midnight. It's my brother. I've been singing a song about you, I say, and sing, Christmas minus Linus.
It's catchy, Linus says. You have a gift.
The thing is, I'm not allowed to find fault, not with his litany of excuses, not when so many resemble my own. I'm wearing somebody else's coat, I realize. I don't know who the coat belongs to. I don't remember seeing a person encased in this particular coat walking in, but it isn't a very effective coat. The owner is probably inside wearing an impractical outfit. She's going to be too drunk to be concerned about the weather once the party is over. I'm not sober, but I am also not drunk enough to be unaware that I'm freezing. I've never liked New Year's. The trouble with beginnings is that there's no such thing. What's a beginning but an arbitrary point of entry? You begin when you're born, I guess, but it's not like you know anything about that. A few weeks after the engagement, someone asked what I was looking forward to about marrying Joel, and I thought, the clarity. But that was kind of pulled out from under me. Also, I loved saying the word fiancé, which, whatever. Poor, poor me. Back in the apartment, people are kissing at random and Bonnie is on the telephone, probably with Vince, the boyfriend she's been meaning forever to dump. And Charles is still pink. And now also pantsless, cleaning up a champagne spill with paper towels. His pants are across the room, absorbing a different spill. A crowd is arguing about which make better pets, guinea pigs or gerbils, and Jared is having a Valium. I finally find my plastic cup, which I've starred with a Sharpie, in a stack of other cups. Originally it was champagne, and now it's champagne swished with bourbon. Because my thinking is always, if I'm going to poison myself, why not make it count? Earlier Jared had said that we were young, youngish, he corrected, and that a year was a long time not to be doing what you wanted to be doing. He was a sushi chef, he'd said, but somebody else I later talked to laughed and said meanly, "Chef is one way to put it." This person had been to Jared's restaurant. Jared filleted the fish and pulled pin bones out of salmon. And it was the real chefs who did all the slicing. Jared wore a hairnet on his beard. And now, even later, back at Bonnie's place, Bonnie and I sit on our balcony eating peanuts and ranch dressing from a big bowl with a spoon, sharing her blanket. We can hear the parties all around us, picking up and losing steam. We watch the lights blink on and off over the hills across the city. "You know what happened yesterday?" Bonnie says. "Yesterday, we had someone walk into the salon and ask what the price was for a shampoo and blow job."
"And you gave it to him?" I say.
"She was a paying customer," Bonnie says. I realize, horrified, that I'm wearing Joel's ring. I've been carrying it in a pocket in my purse. I can't remember putting it on. I jiggle the ring off and drop it back in the purse where the sea of junk engulfs it immediately. Bonnie is looking at me, it appears, with fondness. "Are you," it occurs to me, "admiring your haircut?" And suddenly, somehow, it is 3 in the morning and we are back to the vodka and carrots. "Here's to the new year," I raise my glass. "Here's to new leaves." "I'm going to be nicer this year," Bonnie says, "but meaner to Vincent. I'm going to keep a clean purse." "You're going to find it in yourself," she says sternly, "to be okay." "To being okay," I cry. "New year, new leaf." "New leaf," I repeat, and we drink. January 1st. Sometimes I like a hangover because it's something to do. This morning's is a rodent. Pesky, but manageable. The allergy to ibuprofen I get from my mother. From her, I've also inherited the tendency to headaches and fevers that do not respond to one anything. First order of business this morning is 2 aspirins and a glass of water. In last night's dream, I got caught in the rain. Joel had been holding our umbrella, but he left me. He wandered off to follow a dog that was wearing pants. Fortunately, I was wearing a coat of salami. The rainwater beaded on it and glided off. I rifled through Bonnie's paintings propped up against her living room wall, there collecting dust and cobwebs, which I brush off with a sleeve. She drifts into the room, rubs her eyes. "These are good," I say. "They're garbage." "This is beautiful," I say, holding one up. It might be a self-portrait. It's not obviously so. The subject has the same color hair and same color skin and same color eyes as Bonnie. "Take it," she says, waving her hand like it's a pair of two small shoes she has no use for. Bonnie has funny indents on her face from where her glasses were. She fell asleep with them on. Noticing my hair, she immediately tries to smooth it out with her hands. "Thanks for the haircut," I say. "Welcome home," she says, and gives my hair one last admiring look. At home, my parents are on the couch, clutching tall glasses of pink-orange something. The Rose Parade is on TV. Mom's feet are inside the bottoms of Dad's pants, her way of keeping them warm. "That's nice," Mom says about Bonnie's painting. The pink stuff, it is explained to me, is cantaloupe juice. "I call it melonade," Mom says. Mom's quit cooking, like a person might quit smoking or gambling. This is on account of Dad. What she's figured is that it was the years of cooking in aluminum pots, cooking with canned goods, that led to the dementia. She's thrown out the aluminum pots and pans and tossed the tin foil. She's been reading the online literature on dementia. What she's read: the brain uses minerals to function, and when magnesium isn't available, it uses the next available mineral, aluminum. In large quantities, it can cause nervous tissue damage, though the studies aren't 100% certain. This is my mother, who once made all our meals from scratch. Our sushi, our ketchup, our English muffins. She used to sneak her own popcorn into movie theaters because she objected to the butter from the pump. This is my mother, who cooked dinner every night and, even into high school, never missed an opportunity to pack a sack lunch. This is my mother now, who seems wary of everything, who seems to trust only juices and vitamins to do the least amount of harm. Joel never did like California. He always talked about leaving. Out loud, I'd agree, but inwardly, I held out hope he'd change his mind, that I'd win him over. We've been here forever. My dad's side, I mean. From Ireland and Germany to New York and Pennsylvania. My father's great-greats came to San Francisco and Santa Barbara and Pasadena and Palm Springs. So why not be here, in this house where I grew up and where my parents still live? I was born in Fontana, the next town over, on an afternoon in July 30 years ago. My mom was 25 and newly parentless. Parentless, again, when she had me. That same year, her adoptive parents were in a car accident and died. Her biological parents most likely continued living in China. She had no information about them. Maybe they thought of her constantly. Maybe they thought of her never. Maybe they thought of her sometimes or on special occasions, like when they became grandparents to children who were not me. In any case, my mother was without a family. Without a family, but us, I mean. There's a photograph in the living room that hangs above the piano. It was taken in the hospital in the hours after I was born. In it, Dad looks like a hirsute, Buffer Linus, with his unruly brown beard and enormous plastic glasses. He is wearing a black and white patterned t-shirt. You can see the top of his tight red pants. On a previous doctor's visit, Dad had picked up a pamphlet titled, "What Can My New Baby See?" "Newborns have difficulty focusing," the pamphlet said. "It's impossible to know for certain that they perceive color at all. But in studies, they respond to the color red and to high contrast patterns." Next to him, my Uncle John is shirtless. Because it's waist up, he doesn't appear to be wearing anything at all. When John arrived at the hospital in a red shirt, my father was furious at his brother. "What's the idea?" my dad said. But John, of course, didn't have any idea at all. He hadn't been scheming. He's a colorful dresser because bright colors are always on sale. He was wearing his regular clothes. Dad was beside himself with anger. He refused to let John in to see me wearing the shirt. What you see in the photograph is my mother, stunning, despite her 80s perm and with his tired but amused look. My father, scowling, and Uncle John, shirtless, holding baby me, smiling nervously. One of the floats on TV is a mechanical turtle made from moss and sunflower seeds. "It's not the seed parade," Dad says in a bad mood. Mom deftly peels an orange. She opens my father's palm and puts the segments in his pried-open hand. The bad mood is because last week, Dean Levin called to inform Dad that he would not be teaching this next semester. These past several months, Dad's missed several classes, insisted on another professor's parking spot, and wept in the lecture hall without apparent cause. There had been, Levin said, complaints. Further inconsistencies, as he put it, couldn't be risked. My father could have his job back when he recovered, when he could behave himself again. Levin had said, when, but what he really meant, what we all knew he meant, was if. The floats must be covered in entirely natural materials, the announcer said. Flowers, yes, but also tapioca pearls and cranberries are permitted. My mother hands us each a B12 pill, which we wash down with celery juice. B12 builds myelin, she explains, which our nerves need to fire. Celery, a brain food, contains luteolin, which combats inflammation. The house is virtually snackless. She's emptied the pantries of food she's deemed harmful. Everything is a potential cause of the disease. Cereals and breads contain sugar, and high blood sugar exacerbates the disease. Saturated fats raise the risk of the disease. In lieu of our regular salt is low-sodium salt. We have bananas on the counter and a packet of turkey where the butter should be, and miscellaneous fruits and vegetables for juicing. We have nuts, and we have the last shards of a box of Triscuits. Something Mom does when she's frustrated is she adjusts the arm of phantom glasses on her temple. She got her eyes lasered 4 years ago, but tonight I notice her pushing at invisible glasses, watching a TV that isn't turned on. Another reason I know she's not herself. On Christmas, typically her favorite holiday to cook, we went to a buffet, on top of which she didn't take any baked potatoes for the road. I read, Alois Alzheimer was the senior physician at the Municipal Mental Asylum in Frankfurt when Frau Augusta Dater was admitted. The year was 1901. She was a 51-year-old woman who was anxious and forgetful and, near the end of her life, behaved aggressively and unpredictably. She died 5 years later. Cutting Augusta's brain open, Alois Alzheimer found abnormal protein deposits surrounding her nerve cells. He called them plaques, neuritic or senile plaques. He also found twisted fibers inside the cells. He called those tangles. When plaques and tangles interfere with the normal function of brain cells, that's what we know as Alzheimer's. The neurons are trying to connect. That's what their function is. That's what they do. But the plaques and tangles prevent the nerve cells from transmitting their normal messages. The cells aren't able to communicate with one another because of abnormal protein deposits in the spaces between them. The cells keep trying and trying and trying, but in the end, they're choked off. In the end, they die. I wish they'd named it Augusta's, because Alzheimer's? Really? When she was the one who'd suffered. January 5th. Mom is at book club. Meanwhile, it is impossible to get Dad out of his office. Earlier, I considered slipping cold cuts under the door. I draw a fingernail on each banana. I rearrange the fruit bowl. Now the lemons are resting on top and the kiwis lurk beneath. At one point, Dad emerges, shirtless, into the kitchen to brew himself coffee. I get my nipples from him, I realize, alarmed. In her absence, Mom has given me 2 20s to order pizza, our fourth or fifth since Christmas. The sausage topping looks to be spelling, hi, Like, maybe the pizza maker heard the desperation in my voice and wanted to send me an encouraging message. Mom's all-ladies book club is reading Anna Karenina. Anna's newly pregnant, and I'm picturing all the ladies taking the opportunity to share stories about their own pregnancies. My mother, I know, is probably bragging that I ripped her favorite pair of jeans. In one of Mom's magazines, there is an article about how to keep your man. Never surprise him with short hair. Don't try to change him. Play games, but not too many. I catch a glimpse in the window's reflection and surprise myself with short hair. Here's something I haven't thought about in forever. Once, on an afternoon in the third grade, Dad was picking me up from school when we noticed, in the parking lot, a dozen or so hysterical pigeons assembled on the windshield and hood of another car. We got closer and saw why. There were French fries scattered inside the car on the dashboard. We watched the desperate birds pecking at the glass for a moment before my father said, "Let's go." He took us to the nearest drive-thru. We bought milkshakes and fries and headed back to the parking lot where we drank the milkshakes and fed those pigeons a fry at a time. That's the memory I used to conjure whenever Linus would telephone to tell me what was going on. Whenever Linus said about our father, "He's a liar, and he's a drunkard, and he's a cheat." And I would listen in silence and comfort my brother, all the while thinking, "No, that's not possible. No, you've got it wrong." Linus's deal is that he's angry with Dad. On account of the 5-year age difference between us, things weren't the same for him. Linus was in the 8th grade when I left for college, and the next year our father was drinking again. What happened was he hadn't had a drop when we were growing up, and after I left, he did. In the middle of the night, under the impression I am hearing gunshots, I realize that more likely it's the television. And it is. Downstairs, Hawaii Five-O was on TV, and Dad is nursing a mug of something steaming. I inquire about it. He's put Triscuits and hot water together and created a sort of Triscuit gruel.
"Hungry?"
he asks. "Now I am," I joke.
"Here, take this curved yellow fruit,"
he says, unhinging me a banana. "You mean banana?" I say, trying my best not to sound terrified. There is a pause before he says,
"I'm joking, daughter."
We watch episode after episode in silence until somehow several hours manage to elapse. "Shall we," I say, "give sleep another go?"
"I don't go to sleep,"
my father says with some indignation.
"I go to sleeps."
"Good night, Dad," I say, not adding that I know exactly what he means, though I am my father's daughter. And I do. It's occurring to me that I can't not stay. Just the year, I'm going to tell my mother. Just the year is all it will be. January 6th. But first, it's back to San Francisco. There's my job I have to quit and all the things still in my apartment. I start driving in the morning and reach San Francisco by mid-afternoon. First stop is the medical center. My supervisor is in the cafeteria, bent over a tangle of low mane, looking too young to be a supervisor and tired, like he always does. He likes to use diamond as a term of measurement.
"Just a diamond,"
he sometimes said if we were at lunch together and I was squeezing ketchup onto both our burgers. I like that. This past Halloween, he and I showed up at the same party in matching outfits we hadn't planned. He was the Burger King and I was the Dairy Queen and, a little bit drunk, newly disengaged from Franklin, who had been distracting me from my disengagement from Joel, I put moves on him. He was having troubles with his girlfriend at the time and did not refuse them. "So," I say now, taking a seat in the empty chair across from him. "I quit, I guess."
"Just like that,"
he says. He tears open a packet of hot sauce with his mouth. This can't be coming as a surprise. I like my job, I'm adept enough, but I was never anything special. "Just like that," I say. He wordlessly tosses me his fortune cookie. He has a policy about eating the cookie first. He insists on eating the cookie before reading the fortune. Not eating the cookie, he believes, voids the fortune. I eat the cookie to indicate to him that I haven't forgotten. "To remember is to understand," I read out loud. "That's dumb," I say, without thinking. And right away I regret it, because what if these were actually the words of a famous wise person? Words that everybody else knew about, but somehow I'd missed encountering. Maybe Jesus had said it. Or maybe Confucius. I ask him how Christina is doing. Christina is his girlfriend. At Halloween, he'd been having troubles with his girlfriend at the time, not his girlfriend at the time. When they got back together after the Halloween incident, it was a relief to us both. "We're looking for a place together," he tells me. "Something month to month. She's afraid to sign a 1-year lease." "What's so bad about a 1-year lease?" I say. "That's what I said." "Here's what you do," I say. "You say, let's get married. And wait a moment before you say, just kidding. Let's sign a 1-year lease. Let's have 5 kids. Let's sign a 1-year lease. Let's move in with my parents. It'll save on rent," he says, catching on. "Let's sign a 1-year lease. Let's adopt a child from Korea. Let's sign a suicide pact. No? How about a 1-year lease?" "See you next year," he says. "See you next year." I agree. The light coming in through my apartment's bay windows would be pretty, except all it does is illuminate the dust on the floor. I never fully committed to unpacking. I feel not even the slightest attachment to this apartment. I fill a big suitcase with as many clothes as it will take, and the rest of the clothes I throw into a garbage bag for the Goodwill. I pack one box and then 2 more, and when it still seems I have not made a dent in my belongings, I decide to trash the rest. For example, the jar of old almonds on my desk. I like to collect those almonds with the slight curve, the ones that hold your thumb. And not only the curved nuts, but also the nuts that don't have the standard tear shape. That are shaped more like buttons, with a rounded edge instead of the point. Almond anomalies. What a ridiculous person I am. I unscrew the jar and tip as many anomalies as will fit into my mouth. They're stale and it hurts to chew. I give myself the hiccups. For example, ticket stubs to movies Joel liked more than I did. His spare car keys. A receipt from the airport drugstore from when, the morning after a red eye, I bought mascara to wear in an attempt to look less tired. Joel was picking me up. In the end, I looked worse. Seeds from the one time we broke our own rule and shared an apple in bed. It was grotesque, the way I kept trying to save that relationship. Like trying to tuck an elephant into pants. I put the guitar I never play anymore on the curb. I sweep and mop. I hear somebody pick the guitar up and start strumming a Simon and Garfunkel song. The doorbell rings. It's Maxine Grooms, M.D., here to help with the furniture. "Why to say goodbye?" Grooms says unhappily. "I'll miss you," I say, and hug her tightly. Grooms was the one who happened to be around when I'd caught her and myself off guard by crying after a fight with Joel 1 week near the end. We'd always been cordial, but at that point, we couldn't have exchanged more than 10 words. What could we have in common, was what I'm sure the both of us had thought. She is 10 years older than I am. She wears tall, high heels with her doctor's coat. She wears expensive glasses and the perfect complimentary shade of lipstick. She appears flawless and smells amazing, always. Patients respect her implicitly. We were at work, and I was waiting for the handicap stall that she was coming out of, and she could have simply left me, looking sad and red as a tomato. But she didn't. She stood next to me outside the bathroom and gave my back a few awkward pats. We had no choice but to become friends after that. Now we are having a last dinner together at the Spaghetti Shack. A dinner I'm buying because I feel responsible. Because it was my fault, our becoming friends. That's what I think sometimes. Who is to blame for this friendship? After spaghetti, after wine, we tipsily drag my mattress to the curb. Within the minute, we watch a man in a Buick pull up. He pushes the mattress onto the top of his car, doesn't bother tying it down or anything, and drives quickly away. 4 years ago, grooms had been married, and 2.5 years ago, her husband had left her for his barista, who was younger but less pretty and less smart. And last year, the divorce was made official. "But there are days now," was what she said after she found me crying in the bathroom. "I wake up and it's like none of those ugly things ever happened." "You're the doctor," I said. "What's your prescription?" "Try not to feel too shitty," was her main piece of advice. "Stop always at 2.5 drinks. Make a list of good things, however small." I did everything she said. Granted, I would have tried anything. I often wrote 2.5 in Sharpie on the back of my hand nights before I went out. A reminder. I bought a notebook and started keeping a list. Found a $10 bill in the back pocket of jeans from the thrift store. Found a parrot-shaped leaf. Watched a woman reach her arms overhead and stretch in a satisfying way. "I didn't want to show you this," Groom says, "because I didn't want to jinx it. But it's really, really happening." She pulls a photo from her wallet. The baby boy she's been in the process of adopting. He's a miniature Michelin man. His name is Kevin. Soon, I'm asking grooms, "Do I say goodbye to Joel?" "You've said goodbye to Joel," she says, annoyed, like, "What's your problem? Have you learned nothing?" I'm ashamed to have chased her news with this. We say goodbye, or I say goodbye, and grooms grunts her disapproval affectionately. I drive to Santa Cruz, where Linus lives, not bothering to call ahead. He's between semesters, which I know means he'll be home trying to write his dissertation, but more likely watching DVDs borrowed from the library and cursing when he has to skip over the damaged parts, which inevitably there are. At the exact moment I pull up, my brother is standing at his mailbox. He peers at me, like he's trying to focus on something through the bottom of a glass. I roll my window down. "Need a lift?" "Nope," Linus says, not skipping any beat. "No thanks." "You're gonna leave me all alone," I say. "Down there? With those people?" He takes a good long look at his mail. 10 years ago, Linus was a junior in high school and I was away at college. Our father took up with another professor at the school. She taught physics. It had gone on for 6 months when our mother found out. They were never very scrupulous. After which there were apologies and there was counseling. The professor moved away, and that was the end of that. My parents never broached the subject with me. Over the phone, they kept conversation light. It was Linus who relayed the goings-on, how strained their relationship had become, how miserable my mother seemed, how helpless. He chose her side easily. The whole thing caught me by surprise, still surprises me. Anyway, the point is, Linus sees things differently. Inside his apartment, on his couch, sit neat towers of clean, folded laundry. Linus moves them. His girlfriend, Rita, is a flight attendant. She's often gone and isn't home now either. "Alaska," Linus says without my asking. Also, without my asking, he hands me a beer and deftly fashions a trail mix out of little airplane pretzel and peanut packets. He empties them into a bowl. He makes the bed for me with a flat sheet and airplane pillows. He brings me a blanket. He opens the medicine cabinet where there are sample sticks of deodorant and spare toothbrushes and flat dehydrated sponges for taking on trips. The sponges save luggage space. They expand on contact with water. He says I'm welcome to use anything, which moves me. "How is he?" Linus says finally. This is after 3 beers. He's put his library DVD of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on TV. He asks the question while juggling the socks he's rolled into balls. I know it's a hard question for Linus to ask. The socks mean he can't ask me straight. I want to dignify it with a response befitting the courage he's mustered. But all I can manage is, "He's fine." Linus knows what I mean. That he's his stubborn self, unwilling to accept help. After the movie ends, we change the channels. On one, a woman has buried herself beneath her belongings. All around her there are cartons of expired things she can't bear to throw away, and a flattened cat. "Can't you come home?" I say finally.
"I've been home," is what he says.
And we let the silence hang there between us, not uncomfortably. He refills the pretzel and peanut bowl. At some point, we fall asleep, the both of us, children nestled among the laundry. January 7th. Linus makes us thermoses of coffee in the morning, and we take them to the beach where the sky is gray and the ocean is gray, and it feels like we're being wrapped in a newspaper. Seagulls are squawking. The gutsy ones come close and give us piercing stares. They look like Jack Nicholson. "He's our dad, though," I say.
"And I don't give a shit," he says.
He sends me off with peanut packets. I get on the I-5 and keep the window mostly rolled down and try to breathe deeply, like Grooms always says I should. But all I can smell is hamburgers or cows on their way to becoming hamburgers. America. My car is completely flush with belongings. I can't see anything in the rearview mirror, and this is causing some distress. I cut west to the 101. I pull over often. I buy a bag of oranges from a man under a rainbow umbrella. I buy lemons from another man a few miles down. I pocket some rocks at Moonstone Beach, and a couple there asks in French accents if I have a steady hand. After I tell them, not really, they hand me their camera anyway. A truck is carrying a wind turbine that looks immense, like a whale. Another truck, all black, says, "Eat more endive." It pulls over to let me pass, and the trucker gives me a small wave as I do. At a rest stop gift shop, I buy a pencil topped with an eraser shaped like an orange and ask the employee how California came to be known as the Golden State. Was it because of the gold rush, or because of the sunshine, or because of the oranges?
"I'll have to ask my manager,"
the employee says, hurrying off. I don't stay to learn the answer. I pull over to get a coffee at a Chevron in San Luis Obispo. The endive truck is parked there, and the trucker is outside, sitting on the curb, eating a wax paper-wrapped apple pie. He has wavy gray hair and is wearing a Harley Davidson shirt. After taking a sip, I cough the coffee onto the sidewalk. My standards for coffee I consider the lowest of low, meaning this stuff is impossible.
"I meant to warn you about that,"
he says, finishing the pie. He tosses me a tiny bottle containing, it says, 5 hours of energy and an astonishing amount of B vitamins. He says the feeling you got from it was like the sun coming up in your head. "That sounds nice," I say.
"Nice,"
he says,
"is the goal."
I used to have scruples about accepting drinks from strangers. Not so much anymore. I take a seat on the curb next to him.
"They're a trippy little veggie,"
he says about endives.
"You grow them in the dark."
He pronounces endives endive. There is a couple also outside the Chevron standing by the trash can. The woman is voluptuous and the man is ruler thin, and they are in their 40s or early 50s. They talk quietly together. He is leaning into her and only their stomachs are touching.
"Vegetable jokes,"
he says.
"It's all I'm good for anymore."
"What do you mean?" I say. He points to the couple.
"Isn't it romantic?"
He takes my empty energy bottle in his hand, which is holding his own empty bottle. It reminds me of church with Joel and his family at Christmas, how after communion Joel would take the little plastic cup that had contained the blood of Christ and stack my cup with his. His hand would brush mine when he did, and I would feel like I was in on something. When the trucker gets up to throw our small bottles away, I notice for the first time the back of his shirt, which says,
"If you can read this, the bitch fell off." "I like to ride a bike,"
he says when he turns around and sees that I've glimpsed the print on his shirt.
"What do you do?"
"Sonography," I say. "Ultrasounds." "How is it working with the whales?" people tend to ask. "Sonography," I usually have to repeat, not sonar. Are they really as friendly as everybody says? They'll continue.